The Royal Air Force celebrates its centenary in 2018, and we might associate its activities taking place in the skies, but a hugely important element of this service was operational underground in the Second World War. During that conflict, men and women who were in the Royal Air Force and the Women's Auxiliary Air Force were stationed in Uxbridge, in a bunker deep below the surface of the earth. And from here, they conducted the Battle of Britain and many other air operations.
Hostile 1-6, be confirmed, please.
Need some more yellow 7s, mate.
Hostile 2-9, now 40 plus. 1-5. Yes, 2-6 and 4-1, detail 27.
One of the people in that workforce was Helen, who is now 94.
I joined up when I was 18. At that particular moment, the war was, we were really up against the wall, and I thought I could have gone on sixth form, but I didn't. Went to Bridge North to be kitted up, and then we went to Morecambe to do basic training, drill and so on, and then were posted. And I had chosen to be clerk, special duties, which was working, you know, tracking enemy aircraft, and it said more quick-fingered and quickness of uptake were more important than education qualifications.
As well as Uxbridge, there were many other Royal Air Force bases around the southeast of England.
You were then sent to
Hornchurch.
Hornchurch, and then from
which
there,
which is a fighter station for 11 Group. It was Hornchurch, Biggin Hill.
Yeah.
North Weald, North Holt,
yeah.
Kenley and Tangmere.
In 2018, the centenary year of the Royal Air Force, the bunker in Uxbridge was opened to the public, with a new museum to inform people about the important work carried out here during the Second World War. At this museum, now called the Battle of Britain Bunker Exhibition, I met Dan Stirland, who works there, and he took me into the plotting room where Helen worked. And he told me more about the work that Helen and the RAF did here. But before going underground, I asked him about the aeroplanes that visitors see when they arrive at the site.
Outside the museum today, there's an aircraft. Mm-hmm. What is that aircraft and why is that here?
So there's a couple out there. One is a Hawker Hurricane, which was the main fighter aircraft used by the RAF during the Battle of Britain. It's thought that the Hurricane shot down more enemy aircraft during the Battle of Britain than any other type of aircraft. The other aircraft on display outside is the Spitfire, which is arguably more famous because of what it went on to do later in the war.
Why was this place chosen as a base for this bunker?
There's a couple of reasons, I think. The first one is that actually air defence had been headquartered at Uxbridge since 1925. But specifically, why did they decide to dig the bunker out at Uxbridge is because, geographically speaking, it's a really good location. It's close to London, but it's not in central London, so it's not at the same risk of attack. And also, although it has been an RAF base since 1918, it has never been an airfield. There's never been runways or anything like that here. There have never been any squadrons based here. It's always just been an administrative
right.
station. And so German intelligence during the war, we guessed, may not have picked it up as being a significant location. We know that the assumption that we made at the time was correct. They hadn't worked out how significant this place was.
Because there was no airfield.
Yeah, and that's partly because from the air it looks like nothing special.
So the aeroplanes outside are purely for people to appreciate what was involved rather than there were aeroplanes.
Absolutely, here. Yeah. I think we do need to make it obvious that this is part of the Royal Air Force. And you know, yeah. when you talk Royal Air Force, people think aeroplanes.
Yeah.
So that's why they're
there.
They
want aeroplanes.
Yeah, exactly, just to reinforce that. And although there were never any aeroplanes based here, the work that was done here was to control those aeroplanes.
Have you ever been in a plane?
No. I would have loved to have learned to fly, but that was expensive. The entrance to the skies was sort of just huts on the top, and the Germans never knew it was there at all. I had no idea.
So the entranceway, when you approached your workplace...
It was just two or three wooden huts on the top. It's sort of right in the corner of this complex.
It looks like you were going into a building.
Yes, yes.
But actually there was a flight of stairs going to take you down underground. So, we've come to the main entrance.
So this is the original entrance. It's all reinforced concrete, and the original blast door is sort of centimetre and a half of steel. And then behind that is the main door into the guard room.
And there's the guard.
Yep, wearing an RF police uniform, but we'll ignore him for the time being and go down the stairs. So the stairs are quite steep because there's a long way to go down.
How far down is it?
It's 60 feet to the bottom, or 18 metres.
Yeah.
And there are 76 steps to get all the way down to the bottom.
Now we're halfway down.
We're halfway down, yeah. So we've got a little landing halfway down, and then the second half, but that is now the bottom that you can see down there.
Were there other entrances, or is this the only one?
There's one emergency exit that leads out from the rear of the building as well.
I think I might have seen that. I came up a funny way.
Oh, really?
There was a bizarre door in a concrete sort of setting.
That probably was
by the woods.
That probably was it. You must have sort of walked up through the park through the back way. And then down into the main body of the bunker. The space is about 30 feet high altogether. Bomb blast layers built into that of layered sand and steel sheeting and all sorts of stuff. We are deep enough that any bombs of that period couldn't have got this deep anymore.
Goodness, so this is much smaller than I thought it would be.
Yeah, it's not huge by any means.
Coming in here now, you've obviously renovated it for the museum, and it looks rather new, but when it was found and done up, didn't look like it was in this state.
A bit of a mix, to be honest. So probably about half of what you see is original, dating back to 1939, 1940. So the wooden days here, that's all original. That's not been touched. The controller's cabins is all original. The clocks are original. But then perhaps most importantly, the map on the table is the original map.
And what does it show? Hard to tell from the angle we're stood at. It's quite a large table.
So, yes, it's big. It's about 3.5 metres across and about 2.5 metres from top to bottom. It shows quite a large area of the UK up at the top side, and then down here at the bottom side where we're standing is a little bit of northern France and Belgium as well. It shows the area of responsibility that this part of the Royal Air Force held.
Okay.
So this is the headquarters of Fighter Command Number 11 Group, and Number 11 Group were responsible for defending the southeast of England, including London.
Well, 11 Group, the country was divided into groups for Fighter Command. The Bomber Command was different, but this is Fighter. And 11 was all the southeast of England. And then we got 12 in the West Country, 10 above Midlands, and then 13 was all Scotland and the rest.
Right, so they're basically the country was divided into different groups.
Yes, but then they were divided into different sectors.
And at the moment you've got a sort of a waxwork figure, if you like, standing at the table holding what looks like
a croupier stick.
Would there have been one person, would there have been many people around here, and what would they have done?
So there would have been about 20 people around the table at any given time. Mostly women, during the Battle of Britain at least, mostly women. They were members of the Women's Auxiliary Air Force, and it was their job to show on the map where any aeroplane over the skies of southeast England was in as near to real time as they could do it.
And you told me you were a clerk, special duties. Tell me what that involved.
Well, that was plotting aircraft. That was doing the plotting for the plots that were coming through on radar.
Right. So that was your job throughout the war? From what date until when?
42, 46. Four years.
So you can see on the map we've got all of these little blocks.
Yeah.
And each one of those blocks represents a formation of aircraft. And there are two types of blocks. We've got these three at the bottom, which are prefixed with the letter H.
Yeah.
That stands for hostile. So they're the enemy aircraft formations that you can see coming across the channel.
Yeah.
And then the ones with the little yellow stalks sticking up with the numbers on,
yeah,
they are our squadron numbers. So they're our fighter aircraft heading out to defend Southeast England against the enemy that are approaching.
Right.
So,
and they've got numbers below them.
That's right, yeah. So you've got the squadron number on the stalk at the top,
yeah,
but then underneath you've got the number of aircraft in that formation. So for example, here you can see 605 squadron, 12 aircraft,
yeah,
and then the 25 is their altitude in thousands of feet, 25,000
feet. So there's a lot of information just, you know, contained in that one little block, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let alone on the map itself.
No, that's right. And there's a lot of blocks on the table. And that is the real amazing thing about the system that you see in front of you. It brings together an awful lot of really complicated information, but displays it in a very simple to read manner.
And who would, so the women would be getting the information, the wax worker's got a headset on and,
yep,
and she's got a mouthpiece so she can talk into, mm-hmm, it. What information would she be getting in and what would she be giving out, if you like?
Okay, so the raw information about those aircraft formations comes from a few places. The enemy aircraft formations, that information comes primarily from our radar system along the coastline.
Sure.
But also from observers in the field, literally men with binoculars. That information is all telephoned through to fighter command, and after a bit of processing ends up in the ears of the plotters working around the table here.
Right.
The information about the friendly aircraft formations, our own squadrons, comes again from those observers in the field, but also from the airfields at which they were based. They're in touch via radio with the pilots, and they're obviously reporting their location back to Earth.
So tell me what being a plotter involved.
Well, what happened was you got plots through from fighter command. They came from all round the coast, where they'd come in from the big pylons.
Yeah.
And the filter gulls, from these blitz, they got a vector that,
yeah,
they could say what it was that was coming in. Anything coming in over the coast was normally going to be,
yeah,
hostile. And so the plots went on in 5-minute intervals.
So that's where the information comes from into their ears.
Yeah.
And it's their job to take that information and use it to make up the blocks and then move the blocks around the map accordingly.
If you've got a plot, northwest S for sugar, 2787, 2787, you put that down there with an arrow. There was a magnet at the top there. You put it on the right plot, facing the right way, and they were yellow and black if they were hostile,
right,
like a wasp. And the friendlies were red and white.
Would each woman be given, for example, a particular squadron to navigate around?
So each plotter was given a particular section of map.
Ah, okay.
And it was their job to do all of the plotting in that particular section of the map.
So do you spend most of your time there around that table that you showed?
Yes, I was mostly an RDF plotter.
And what did you like about it?
It was interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, and you felt you were doing something. We had four watches, A, B, C, D. I was in A. And you went on duty, say, at 8 o'clock in the morning until 12.
Yeah.
And then you went on again in the afternoon, 5 and till midnight. And then you came off duty, and then you went on again in the afternoon of the next day.
And how many people were in the watch in that group?
About 20 or 30 of you. The whole point was to get the fighter aircraft with the plots we got to meet the enemy and then shut up and let them get on with it.
Do you remember the smells or the sounds? What was it? Was it quiet in there?
Well, fairly quiet, but of course if you were plotting on either ROC or RDF, you had your ear for it, and you were just getting the plots through there.
So people weren't chatting, it wasn't a chatting environment?
Not really, no, yeah, no, because
the
you
focus.
Needed, yes, yeah, you need to focus.
On the back wall, there's a 3, 4, 5, 6, mm-hmm, 7 airports, so, mm-hmm, that's probably not the right word, but airfields.
Yeah, yeah.
They're managing all of those different airfields.
That's right. So the 7 airfields on the board at the back of the room are the seven airfields at which our fighter squadrons are stationed. And what the board shows is information about those squadrons. So first of all, you've got the squadron numbers across the top. So straight away, you can see which squadrons are based at which station. But then as you come down the board with the coloured lights, you can see what each of those squadrons is doing at any given moment. So some of those statuses, for example, read at standby or left ground, in position, enemy sighted, and so on. There's information at the bottom of the board as well about the strength of the squadrons. So there's a whole row of P's and A's standing for pilots and aircraft, and that tells them how many of each the squadron had available.
In the ops room, everyone from plotters and tellers to the vitally responsible controller kept at it throughout that Battle of Britain period so critical for the civilized world. Positions of our own fighters were indicated on the board, as well as those of enemy squadrons whose numbers and altitude were shown.
All of the information in this room, every single bit of it, is for the benefit of one individual who sits upstairs behind the glass. So he is known as the controller, and it's his job to decide what to do about the enemy aircraft that are approaching. So he looks down through the glass at the map, and you mentioned about the angle of the map previously. It's specifically angled to give him the best view, and he can see the enemy aircraft approaching across the channel, and he's responsible for doing something about it. So all of the information displayed in here is to help him decide what to do.
God, what a huge job.
Absolutely.
And who was that? Do we know the name of all the names of those people?
We do. So there was only ever one person at a time doing it down here, but they operated a shift pattern because the building was operational 24/7. So there would have been four people at a time sharing the shifts, and then they were rotated through the system sort of every 9 to 12 months or so. So throughout the war, actually, there were quite a lot of those people doing that. At the peak of the Battle of Britain, we know a few of them. So Lord Willoughby de Brooke, the Duke of Hamilton, was another one. And then another couple of RAF personnel, one chap called Thomas Lang. And then plenty of others as well.
So senior military, Air Force people.
Although actually not as senior as you might think.
Right.
So most of them held the rank of wing commander, which really is in the middle of the rank structure, the officer's rank structure. It's not particularly senior. But nevertheless, the responsibility that they held was
immense.
Yeah, I don't think it's overstating it to say that during the Battle of Britain, throughout those 4 months in 1940, those four men were probably the four most important people in the country.
And you did shifts there, and when you weren't on shift, did you sleep there?
We were billeted in RAF Airmen's Merry Quarters, quite a walk away from the bunker. It's a big site, Hillingdon. Of course, it no longer exists.
What did you enjoy the most about being there?
I think friendship, camaraderie, knowing that you were... I mean, we didn't know we were going to win the war, but we hoped we were. But I went on duty on the 5th of June, which was my birthday, actually, for D-Day. And, of course, they put it forward one day. But for the RAF, it was the 5th of June, because that's when they started, you know, sorties from this country. And in the grounds of Uxbridge, it is a big area, and were football pitches and racetracks and so on. They were covered in tentage with people waiting to go for D-Day. And, of course, used to walk and used to see them all shaving, you know, hiya baby, you know, sort of thing. And then suddenly they were all gone.
Maybe
no one
not
how
all
many
of them
actually survived. Yes.
Did you ever get to know any of the pilots or the people who left?
Really,
you were quite separate from
them. Yes. I mean, these people who were waiting to go across for D-Day were obviously there temporarily. I mean, the whole of southeast of England was covered in troops of all, I mean, Canadian, Australian, English, all waiting to go.
And they gave you a lot of warning about this big offensive, or did you know about it in advance, or was it thrown on you,
We didn't really know much about it, but when I went on duty on that evening of the 5th of June, the map was ribboned, where with the beaches, Omaha Gold, were going to be the beaches that they were landing on.
And then the war came to an end, or the European war came to an end in May 45. Mm. And then what happened to this place?
So it continued in operation actually right up until 1958. Right. So it continued to control the air defence of southeast England throughout that period. So into the early days of the Cold War as well.
Do you remember VE Day?
We got drunk. I mean, obviously we got drunk. After the VE Day,
yeah,
everything was dismantled.
But after the war was over, there was no need for then, anybody's jobs
well,
down
we
there.
Well, we were posted to Gloucester, a demob people very gradually.
How did you feel when you demob?
It was, didn't know, we wanted to get on with life.
Yeah.
One of the questions I get asked often is, did you enjoy it?
Yeah.
And I have to say yes, it changed my life. I came from a middle-class background, but I met people that I didn't realise how other people lived. I mean, we had to do you have a week when you had to put an overall on and do the cleaning.
So you're saying the war stirred up the class system, if you like.
It yes,
stirred
it did.
Up society, everyone had to mix in together.
It levelled a great, I mean, not completely, but I mean, it did level out society.
Did you feel like this is, I mean, it is an important job and everyone was doing important jobs, but did you appreciate at the time, because you were young, you're sort of teenager really?
Well, yes, I mean, you were doing a job. Look, there were thousands of us. I was one little sort of speck in all this.
They were the men and women in the back room, the link between radar and our fighting forces. The combined result saved Britain.
Pine Tree leader, Roger 190.
Pine Tree, this is Turkey. 20+ bandits at Angels 2-0 heading west.
Roger, Turkey control.